is to find the other equations. So that together we can find the evolution of universe, which is characterized by the single scale factor A of t. And if we have time, we'll mention the content of the universe. And do a simple example. Really simple example. All right, so what we have seen so far is that we write down the metric. From now on, I'm just going to refer this as the metric. And then from there, we could go from there, or we could use Newtonian mechanics. We find the Friedman equation. The first Friedman equation tells us it's a differential equation for A. And we say if we get it from GR, this will be, this K is the same. Describe the curvature of the universe. And this will be the energy density. Yep.
I have a question.
Yes.
So when you were driving this yesterday,
yes,
we only took into account the radial velocity or acceleration. Yes, acceleration.
Yeah.
But we didn't care about the angular acceleration. Why?
If you have that, then there would be not isolated.
Exactly, yeah. The acceleration caused by having angular velocity.
Well, there is a Newton theorem says that if you have a sphere and you have some gravitational effect, you can just crunch the sphere to the center. It's like the Gauss's law.
Sure.
That's why the force is only radial direction. If you use the Newtonian direction.
Yeah, the force can be radial direction, but if you are, for example, doing a, what's that called, uniform motion? Not the uniform, but it's like...
You can do a uniform circular motion,
exactly.
But that's still not isotropic. The isotropic doesn't have a preferred direction. If you are all doing this, you certainly prefer this over this.
I see. Can't you have a bunch of things doing that?
Yeah, but those are in the universe, of course, but those are the peculiar velocity that we claim they're going to die away as the universe expands. We only care about the homogeneous expansion of the universe. And those are the things that is specific for a particular galaxy configuration, which, of course, was not taken care of. That, so basically, this works before there's inhomogeneous. So this is a completely homogeneous universe. So there couldn't be like galaxies forming and the stars moving around. Right. Okay, very good. Any other question? If you don't have question, I have question. So remember when we do the Newtonian derivation, this is just the connected term plus the potential term equals a integral constant, you can call it. Integral constant is a constant, it can be anything. Total energy, why it should be discrete? That doesn't make any sense. But then we say if you plug this metric in Einstein equation, the result, the K coming from the metric, which was taken to be plus minus 1, 0. So it should be discrete. So what did we do wrong when we do the Newtonian derivation? And I keep emphasizing there's no strong gravity when you have just a gas, a pool of dusts. So what's going on? What's going on is there is a scaling symmetry of the metric, which we actually have used it before. Remember, there are some embedding equations as the radius of the sphere is a square, and we rescale something. Or we can just directly look at this metric. I can always send at to be at divided by something, something. And then, but we have to change r in the same way to multiply by this something. But then I have to scale k such that this term doesn't change. So if this scales down, but the r goes up, but the k goes down again, this is actually a symmetry of the metric. So we can use this to either say, so if you have the scaling symmetry, of course, the plus one can be scaled to be all possible values. The minus one can be scaled to be all minus values. But they're all equivalent because they refer to the same metric. But in practice, actually, we use the scaling symmetry to do another thing. We say, we don't care if this k is actually discrete. We use the symmetry to choose the delta specifically to be at equals 0. And then we use the scaling symmetry now. If you look at this, you divided that away. So you can actually use the scaling symmetry to choose t today. T0 means today. To be 1. So this is a choice because of this scaling symmetry. And this choice together is k equals continuous value. That to be determined, which we will see how to determine that where did you scale the k to be. So you can make two choices. Either you can make an initial condition of the scale factor, in which case you can't fix k to be discrete anymore. Or you can make the different choice, which k is discrete, but then you just have to, you can't choose that, then the initial condition is fixed to a certain value. You can't choose that value to be 1 anymore. Normally, people always make this choice because our universe turned out to be flat. We'll come back to that point next week. So by examining CMB and some oscillations of the universe, basically they say when CMB produced, the entire universe is oscillating, and that must be producing the most power. Then you look at the power spectrum of the CMB, then that will tell the how big the thing that is oscillating is only depending on the curvature of the universe, but not anything else. So that will actually determine if the universe is flat or not very accurately. And it turned out that our universe is very close to flat. So flat that we'll encounter something called a flatness problem. Like we'll become worried that our universe is a little too flat. And the inflation claims that, okay, it actually works. The inflation will solve that problem. So this is a little puzzle. But now we could just look at this three-dimensional equation as we have taken today's scale factor equals 1, and this k is just some constant. Okay, as I said yesterday, we do have a differential equation of a, and unfortunately we can't solve it. Because now we introduced a new variable called the energy density. What's the energy density of the universe? Who knows? We'd better have some differential equation for the energy density to figure that out. So here, there's also two roads. You can, if you have checked out the notebook that try to find the three-dimensional equation from the Einstein equation, of course, the Einstein equation gives you everything. And you can look at the spatial component. So this is the time component of Einstein equation. But if you look at the other component and with some play with it a little bit, you will get the differential equation of rho. And also, remember Einstein equation has this double agent rho that some of you get tested on. So you can also get it from the GR conservation, which is actually doesn't imply anything is conserved, this thing. If you do this in GR with this metric, you would also get the differential equation of the energy density. So there are many rows, but we'll continue taking the simple rows, which is start with something that has nothing to do with GR. Says that the thermodynamic, the first law, one of those laws that we always remember is that the first law of thermodynamics says something relates the internal energy with the heat flow and the work. So those are two sources of energy, and the sum must be equal to the change of internal energy. Oh, true. For a universe, homogeneous universe, everywhere the temperature is the same. So there is no heat flow. They are all at the same temperature. So we happily take the left-hand side to be zero. And I can just write this, just divide this whole thing by dt. And we happily have E dot plus PV dot equals zero. Yeah, nothing fancy so far. And now, this is time we take the expansion of universe. I know there is some prefactor, such as V0, which is a constant. Let's just take that to be 1. Says that the volume of the universe is given by a to the cube of the t, because each dimension is scaled by a t, so 3 dimensions, a cube of t. OK. Now we're basically done. We just have to do some derivatives. We have V dot, which is 3a squared t a dot. And we can do the same trick. We divide a and multiply a. You can see this trick is always working. It always gives back what we start with and pick up a factor of h. OK, so there's nothing. Then we're just using this very innocent formula says the energy equals energy density times volume. That seems to be the definition of energy density. So now we continue to perform the derivative, which gives us E dot, which is equal to rho dot V plus rho V dot plus PV dot, rho dot V plus rho plus P, and we can get that V dot, which is 3VH, still equals 0, means we get rid of the V, and here we have, without much sweat, the evolution of the energy density, which is also known as the continuity equation. After all, we are coming from this thermodynamics. Says that things, it's called the fluid equation, continuity equation, which is the same thing is telling us the energy density has to behave this way if we want the universe to expand in a way that it's always homogeneous without a heat flow. So that's our second Friedman equation. And in GR, you'll get the same thing. So, great. Now we have a differential equation of the energy density. There's the problem, isn't it? Now we introduce the pressure. Well, there is one more step to go. is to find, hopefully, there's some relationship between them. Otherwise, we still end up having one more variable than equations, then we still can't solve it. So this thing is called the equation of state. It's like you have a guess of some sort, and you want to know what's the relationship of the density and the pressure. So for a long time when I was preparing the lecture, I just want to tell you, you know, for radiation, rho equals 1/3 p. Then even myself that can't be convinced that is true. So unfortunately, we're going to do a slightly longer derivation to convince ourselves, okay, it is true. No, I mean, p equals 0 for dust, so that's easy to understand because pressure is determined by the speed related to the speed, like kinetic energy. Pressure is like things knocking. If you have a container, you have a container and you have a gas and it knocks on it and there's some momentum transfer, then there's pressure. So if you have a dust, like the massive particle, then this momentum transfer is related to the speed since they are non-relativistic compared to the rest energy, that's negligible. That's the definition of the dust, is that the kinetic energy is not important for them. So that's easy to understand, p equals 0 for dust. But if I have a bunch of photons, how do I demonstrate that rho is actually related to p? And then I'm troubled. So we're going to go through some derivation, but since we're going to go through some derivation, let's not assume anything about their kinetic energy and the momentum and just do it for general. So I have some particles, and well, we still have this relationship, is that the energy is always given by this. So that's always true for a particle. But for in general, we have a particle like that. And how would we relate it? The energy density and the pressure. So the first step is think about, OK, we're going to do it the other way. It doesn't matter. If you have one, of course, you can solve for the other. OK, so we want to calculate the pressure. Well, let's first write down what do we mean by energy density. So this is also something you learned from statistics, is that there is some distribution function. You can integrate it over the momentum space, then you will get a number density. That's like the definition of a distribution function. And of course, if you are bosons, you have some bose Einstein distribution, and you have some Fermi-Dirac distribution, and in the limit, you have some Maxwell distribution. For photon, you have like Planck distribution. But all the distribution means the same thing. If you integrate it over the momentum space, maybe there was some number. We can, in our particular case, we're focusing one specific particle. We can just absorb it in the distribution. What the distribution function means is that you will get a number density by integrating over the moment. It basically says it's the number density at a specific moment. Okay? With this, it's very easy to write down what do you mean by energy density. You just multiply by the energy of individual particle. Yeah? If your integrand is 1, you get a number density, but if each particle has energy, you get energy density. So our job is to do the same thing for pressure, says what could I possibly integrate over to get the pressure. Yeah? Well, pressure. This is what we learned, in first year in undergrad, pressure equals force divided by area. Well, we like to do things infinitesimally. So let's pick a teeny area. So it's force divided by a teeny area. And I can even draw this teeny area. That's my teeny area, dA. And I'm going to study the force that's going to act on it. And then continue what we learned in undergrad is that the force is equals to the momentum divided by time, or impulse. Yeah? That's what we learned. Good. Now we just need to figure out, well, this is clear, there's not much we can do about this. dA is what I pick, and dt is some time. We just have to figure out the momentum that is transferred. Actually, the simple thing to figure out is how much momentum is transferred by one particle. The hard part is to figure out how many particles are there. So we're going to do it in two steps. I'll do the simple one, is that if you have a momentum and it's trying to shoot at that area, well, only the perpendicular area counts, and the momentum comes in and it bounced back, so there is a factor of two. So that's the momentum transfer. And you still have these guys tagging along. And now we have to multiply by all the particles that are going to hit that area. So for each one particle, it's going to transfer from this momentum. And let's draw this. There is an arrow N. Okay, now let's try to figure out how many particles are going to hit it. So first of all, we realize a simple fact is that between t and the delta t, all the particles that are ever going to hit that area comes from this spherical shell, right? And they are all v times t, r equals v times t away, and this is the thickness, which is v times delta t. Otherwise, they're not going to arrive at the area, at the moment that we're interested. So let's see, the volume of this and that's the thickness. So this is the volume of all the spheric shell that's going to be able to hit this area at time t. Between time and t, these are all the particles that's going to hit it. And since we like to infinitesimal things, okay, here we're again only going to take a infinitesimal volume, which the only thing I'm doing is replace the 4 pi by d omega square, which integrates to be 4 pi. So this, I'm going to only study this little piece at this moment. And this little piece has this much volume. And if I multiply by fp integrated over d3p, this is the number of the particles ever going to hit it, ever had a chance. Okay, there's one more step, then we can combine everything to get the area. The next step is saying that there is another problem, is that the guys that is going to hit this area is not all these particles. Because remember, they are isotropic. So these particles also have a sphere over here. Those guys has the freedom to hit that entire sphere rather than that little area we choose. So which means that entire sphere has area 4 pi r squared, and we are only going to hit the perpendicular area. So the whole number density that is actually going to hit the area that is going to be related to our pressure is again suppressed by this factor. So now we have this thing, and we can multiply by Fp and the integrate over the d3p. So these are the numbers that are going to hit that little area that we're interested in.
Sorry, could you just explain that last part again?
Yep. So there's three steps. The step one says that if all the particles at the time t that's going to hit that area reside in this sphere cell. And let's just only study this infinitesimal volume because we can just do the integral to figure out how so thing. But if we look at these particles we select, they have isotropic velocities. So if you just set this amount of particle free with the isotropic velocity, they have their free will to hit anywhere on this sphere. So the fraction that's going to hit the area we are interested is the area we are interested divided by the sphere. But only the perpendicular area is interesting. Okay, now we are finally done. We just plug this thing. Well, okay, let me simplify things a teeny bit. Just by cancel this little r square away, little r square away. And I'm going to move the speed and combine that to be that. Okay, this is kind of silly. Wait, I don't have to do it. All right, so let me just copy everything down in a gigantic formula. So we have pressure is given by the individually particle with a transfer some momentum. And then we divide up a momentum by T to get a force, divided that force by area, get the pressure. But then we have to multiply how many particles are actually hit it. And that's what we just explained, is that only the ones hit the perpendicular area matters, and the total number of particles in that little unit solid angle is this much. And then we integrated, we multiply by the distribution, integrated by the d3p, we'll get the pressure. So this one is p of pressure, the pressure, sorry, I tried my best to distinguish pressure and the momentum. I understand pressure is p, why momentum is p? Okay, so this is all we need. So don't be scared by this because things cancels out. There's dt cancels out, dA cancels, oh, dA cancels out, dt cancels out. And this guy is given by the magnitude of the momentum times the magnitude of this velocity. There's only 2 pi left. And that's just cosine theta squared because that's the definition of the dot product. And now I'm actually going to write out the line element of d omega squared. And there is a FP that it's just tagging along. So now we just integrate over some volume. But the, yeah, everything cancels out. The most important part of going through the entire calculations is that now we have to integrate over this cosine theta square. So this integral doesn't give us 4 pi anymore. Okay, so now we just have to do simple integral. Keep in mind that we only integrated over a half hemisphere. You only integrate the moment towards the target. If it's inertial moving the other way, then it's hopeless. Okay? Which means the defi, okay, this is very sloppy, but the defi always give us 2 pi, who cares? We only need to do this integral between 0 and the pi over 2, because that's a half semisphere. So this is a calculus problem, sine theta d theta will just give you cosine theta. So this thing gave you 3 cosine theta cubed from 0 to 1, give you 1/3. So 2 pi cancels out, and this is 1/3. So this gives you 1/3 PV F. And the last step is realize that it's just people commonly write it in that way, which is true, is that the relative slay V is equals to P over E, because this is M gamma, this is M gamma V. So this is what you typically see in the book, is to say the pressure is given by D3P, FP, and this, the question mark we have up there is P squared over 3E. And that the 3 is the important factor by doing this analysis, realize something like you have to hit the target perpendicularly and only the perpendicular momentum is taking into account. And you arrive at this result that you can look it up in any book. Yep.
I'm not really sure. I don't understand why we're only integrating over half the hemisphere. Like, didn't we take that into account when we divided by the 4 pi squared back there?
Yeah, so these guys. Oh, you were saying. You were saying that if we divide it by 4 pi, then it's only the particles moving towards the A. It's only the velocity moving that direction. So you're saying that factor 2 is taken care of here.
I'm not sure, but that's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
One side of the target, and you have to be moving towards the target.
Uh-huh.
Right, so because you are integrating over magnitude of P, you get an extra factor of 1/2. Because you only take into account P in one direction, not in the other.
In which step?
Well,
the integral is over. Okay, so you're saying that when we are integrating this sphere, and I'm integrating over, I'm already doing the magnitude of P.
But the particle can move away from the target.
True, but I think what she is saying that when we pick this factor, that we see all these particles has the possibility of hitting this entire sphere. And if we do that factor, then the selected the particles is already moving towards them.
Oh yeah, well, then it's the other factor of one half that's missing. Because uh-huh. you only have particles on one side of the target, right? Yeah.
And then there's the other side?
Well, the other side doesn't matter, right? Because yeah, like, you have uh-huh. boundary, and inside there's the photon gas, and outside there's no photon gas.
Uh-huh. Oh, you're saying that all the photons reside on this side of the target.
Yeah.
True. Okay, thank you. Very good. So in the original argument, there the factor of two that are missing is that we consider all there is gas in this container, and then there's the container boundary, and Leander pointed out outside there's no gas. So we should only integrate half of the hemisphere. Thank you. Ah, very good. That's awesome. So let's take some limiting cases. Now this is very clear that if I take a dust, will give me P goes to zero compared to energy. That's the definition of the dust, is the kinetic energy doesn't matter, which tells us we always call them pressureless dust. So then now we can take the other limit, says photon, that you can take P basically equals E. Then of course, this gives you P equals 1/3 of rho. Particularly in general, in cosmology, they like to unify things, like they like to write the metric in one metric. So, interestingly, they write this as P equals W times rho, because as you see, the cases we're interested, they are all just a linear relationship with a constant coefficient. And there's one more thing we're interested in. It's kind of bizarre to propose that we are even interested in this. And you know, Einstein proposed, let's be interested in this. And then he was like, no, that's my biggest mistake. But then, of course, we have evidence support. We should be interested in it. And actually, it's so interesting that nobody knows what's going on. And of course, what I was talking about is the cosmology constant. So for a cosmology constant, since it's an energy density everywhere in the universe, and if you look at our freedom equation, there's energy density there. So the cosmology constant, of course, will contribute to the universe's evolution. Well, if it doesn't contribute, it wouldn't fix our problem. So let's figure out what's the equation of state for a cosmology constant. And then first time in our lecture, we're going to write down Einstein equation. Okay. With a cosmological constant. Uh-huh. Now I'm going to do simple manipulation by moving the cosmological constant to the right-hand side. And the next thing to do is, I'm sure you have seen in GR, is that if it's on the right-hand side, you're going to propose this thing called is some energy momentum tensor for the cosmological constant. Yeah? So basically, you can treat this thing as something on the left, or you can treat this thing as something with energy momentum tensor. Then on the left hand side, it's still the Einstein center you get from the metric. Okay, so this is not a hard calculation. It says T mu nu lambda must be given by minus lambda 8 pi j g mu nu. And we can make our life simpler by moving an index up. So this becomes delta. And there's a minus sign. It looks as if it's missing. Okay, now the only thing to do is compare to a perfect fluid. A perfect fluid, you also have seen in AGR. Okay, in our co-moving observer's frame, you can write the perfect fluid like this. It looks homogeneous and isotropic. So you can just compare and then read off that the rho lambda is equals to minus lambda, wait, no, minus sign cancels, lambda over 8 pi j, and the p is equals to minus lambda 8 pi g, which we get that the rho p is equals to minus rho for a cosmological constant. So we have three choices, w equals 0, w equals 1/3, and w equals minus 1 for cosmological constant. So it still fits in the description that a P is equals to W rho. It's nice. Okay. So remember, we go through all this process is because we realize our second freedom equation introduced the pressure, which we don't know. But now we do know. It's just proportion to rho depends on what you are. So now let's just use this. So basically, I'm saying is now we can solve that thing by taking the general assumption that P is just W rho. So now, very good. We are finally left with two equations and two unknowns. Yay. Which means we can, in principle, solve them. And practically, this is also the case. Because this equation is one of this very rare kind that it's separable. So this is already separable. The only thing I need to do is divide the rho over. Okay, standard procedure. We say that a rho dot divided the rho is just log rho dot. And similar for this case, it's just log of a dot. And this means that the rho must be proportional to a to the minus 3, 1 plus w. It's a separable differential equation that you can easily solve, that you get this result. It says, indeed, we know how energy density behaves as the universe expands. It dilutes. It's not surprising at all. And it's even less surprising if we take some specific cases, for example, for dusts. Dusts, W equals zero. It says, for dust, for massive particle, a gas of massive particles as the universe expands, the density fall off because volume increase. Makes perfect sense. And now we can take the photon case that we spend so much effort to get this one-third right. Well, it's indeed very sensible because if you plug one-third in that formula, you get its fall off as a to the minus 4, which means, of course, everything falls off as at least a to the minus 3 because the volume expands. But in terms of the photon, remember, the wavelength gets stretched with the universe, so the energy decays with an additional one factor of a. So photons with four factor of a. So these are all nice things. And of course, for that cosmological constant, you say that W equals minus 1, so it equals constant. It makes sense, because that's what we say, that the cosmological constant acts as a constant energy density. So those are the things that we have in our universe. Well, of course, you can doubt about the inclusion of the cosmological constant, but great, in this afternoon, in the first tutorial, we begin to ask the question, why do we need dark energy? And in the second half of the tutorial, even better, we're going to wonder about the fate of the universe. Ooh. But before that, let's finally try to figure out that thing. Remember the coupled, so now we relate the rho to A, so if we plug this back to our freedom equation, we'll finally have a one differential equation that has one unknown, which is A of t, which means even if sometimes we can't solve it analytically, we can always stick it into some program that says different numerically solve this thing for me. All right, so let's do that. So this is our famous Friedmann equation. So one thing people typically do is that, see, this term is kind of an outlier. That also you always wonder, is our universe flat or not? So what people typically do is define this thing to be the critical density. And now, see if you, okay. Let me write one more step. So I can do this to this term so that this term is just rho. And of course, I have to do it for this term too. What do people typically do? Okay, never mind. Sorry, what I did is some people typically do. So this is rho critical. And we're going to express this h square as 8 pi j over 3 times rho critical. It's just another way to write h square if you define this. Let's just multiply things. And now we have some common factors of of three pi j's. And then you can move things around. And you get this thing. And what typically people claim, well, which is true, is when rho is bigger than rho critical, you have a positive k. So you are living in a closed universe, and you have a positive curvature, and you have the energy density of the universe is bigger than the critical density. And on the other hand, if k is smaller than zero, we will have an open universe. And you will have a negative curvature. And you will have not enough critical density compared to the critical density, it's small. So from this, you know that if your universes have more density than critical density, it will always to be so. And if you don't, you will always not be so. So it doesn't change. The evolution of the universe doesn't change the relative sign of these two things. Then the other thing people typically do is like to describe everything with today. Because if something show up our equation is a value that is today, then it's something we can actually get a number from observing the universe. If it's any other time, we have to actually do the evolution of the universe to figure it out. So typically you will see people will write this equation in terms of things we can measure today. Which what the people typically do, let me write down this equation again, so if there is ever going to be an interview, which there isn't. Let me stress there isn't, but there is one equation I want to get you get out of this entire course, is you should remember freedom equation. If you don't, you should like be able to derive it in 2 minutes at the most. Okay, so this is one equation that governs the evolution of the universe. So what we can do is say, well, since we know that there is only, up to our best knowledge, there's some radiation, some matter, some cosmological constant. And then what we typically do is to define the critical density of the universe today, which is something we can measure because we can measure Hubble's constant. So then we'll divide both sides by h naught square, and then we'll get something like critical density here. Okay. So as I said, we like to express everything in terms of today, but now we can by saying that density at any time is just density today divided by the scale factor, which I secretly use the proposal that scale factor today is 1. So this is no longer discrete. And the last thing people do is to define the energy density parameter of today to be, it's like a fraction. Today there's so much so and so density, and how much percentage it is in terms of the critical value. So the last thing, the thing you send as a Friedman equation that is readily solvable by some programming language of your choice is written like this. And there is some silly thing is to make this term also look like everybody else. It's just a definition, has nothing, there's nothing called a energy density corresponding to the curvature, but you can still define things like that so that the entire Friedman equation looks like h squared over h zero squared equal to something, some density fraction parameter, dimensionless density parameter, decay in some way, some other component, and there is one more term, capture the curvature term. So this is the one people can just say, we can measure these guys today, which along the course will mention how they are measured, but that it can be measured, and you can just plug in this evolution equation and get your answer of the evolution of the universe. So because we can measure all these numbers to some extent, well actually, this is measured in terms of the other three, but you can just plug these numbers in and solve the universe. In the last 2 minutes, we're going to demonstrate a technique called, where there's something going to dominate. They are all decay in some power law form. So let's assume the universe in some period is going to be dominated by only one component, which is almost always true. Like there might be like a little transition period, it's not true, but most of the time, it's basically what I'm saying is you can literally take this, just say, this one is one. It's all matter. I pick that one because that one lasted the longest in the universe of, in the history of the universe. Say, I'll just pick, it's all matter. And this thing is quite solvable. It's a dot square over h zero square equals a minus one. So there is a square, you move over, you get a minus one. And then you can just propose a is proportional to t times some power law, because you look at this, this is going to be able to solve the Bayer power law. And if you solve it, the result is this. In a matter-dominated universe, that's how the universe will behave. And we'll study more single-component universe, how they behave. And I'll say something a little bit more about, for example, these numbers, and I'll give some very brief explanation how we're going to measure them. We'll explain them later in the class more carefully when we get to the point that we can measure them. And then this afternoon is the exciting case that you will calculate the age of the universe and figure out that actually we should have cosmological constant in order not to be conflicted with the oldest star that we observed in the universe, which has an age. And then we'll study the fate of the universe. So if we look into the future, if whatever we measured today is accurate, or what if they are not? We're going to explore the plane, what if the matter and the dark energy has a different distribution, and see what other fate our universe, all other universes could have. And tomorrow we're going to talk about the most important, one of the most important observations that confirms that the universe is accelerating, which is the supernova, which is the best evidence we have for the existence of a dark energy. All right, see you in 4 hours.